Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Geneva Business Insider, that monthly video series where we talk to David L. Smith of the Geneva Business Insider blog at genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com, which, of course, will be linked up in the show notes for this conversation, as it is every month here on CorbettReport.com. David L. Smith, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure, James, and Skype willing, we'll have a good discussion.
Let's cross our fingers and hope the gods of Skype are with us. All right, well, this month, as always, we have an awful lot to talk about, some very big stories that are breaking right at the moment, but probably the biggest of them all on the news agenda these days is the West Africa Ebola outbreak, which continues to spread fear and panic across the globe. And we have some of the latest is, of course, for people who don't know, this is an Ebola outbreak that started back in March in Guinea and has since spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone and is the largest Ebola outbreak in recorded history so far. And unfortunately, the bad news continues to emerge, as the latest includes an emergency coordinator who is claiming that Sierra Leone is unable to contain the outbreak. We have an ex-minister in the government of Sierra Leone that has lost 9 family members to Ebola. And in the very latest that I have, the BBC is reporting that there is now an emergency World Health Organization summit on Ebola taking place right there in Geneva, Switzerland, where you are located. And the conjunction of a deadly pandemic disease and the World Health Organization should raise a few alarm bells, I would hope, in my audience that saw the swine flu hype and panic being spread a few years ago, mostly at that time for the benefit of the vaccine manufacturers. I guess the question on everyone's mind right now, and we'd like to get your take on this, David, is to what extent is this Ebola outbreak, is it a genuine, justified panic that's taking place right now? Is this some sort of panic that will be used to try to sell some type of vaccine or medical martial law, or is this some type of potential bioweapons release, or what's your take on what's happening right now?
Well, first of all, I think for the people who are living in these countries with very little medical help, it's a terrible tragedy for them to have an uncontrolled illness running through the country. For those who don't know anything about it, and my medical knowledge is limited. I mean, Ebola is something which is a virus, and it is contagious, and it has to be more or less physically directly transmitted. It can come from, it can be transmitted between humans, it can be transmitted between animals and humans, and even from bats and from rotting vegetables and things like that. So in a tropical country, for those who have lived in one, which I did for a few years, one is exposed to these things pretty much all the time in the street as one goes along. So at the moment, there are several hundred victims. The several hundred, it sounds very terrible, but when you think there are 1,000 people a day who die in South Africa from the results of HIV/AIDS, overall the numbers are not so impressive as yet, tragic though they may be. So as there is no clearly identified cure for this ailment at the moment, it's obviously a matter of concern that steps have to be put in place to make sure that the spread is limited. And once again, in undeveloped countries where education is not that fantastic for the average citizen, the transmission can continue rampantly without any way of stopping it. I, like you, am deeply suspicious of anything that the World Health Organization does, because it is either used as an excuse to promote their either their image or promote the products of the people whose from the big pharma companies whose representatives are all sitting on the WHO boards. So the whole thing's a bit of a cocktail for serious problems where we don't really know what's going to happen. I think the only thing that can be done really is just to sit back and watch how it develops. And these things have broken out before and died away and disappeared completely. There does seem to be one bit of hope on the horizon, which is in America, where apparently there is some kind of antidote which has been developed from derivatives of the tobacco plant. So at least for once, tobacco is doing something for the good of people instead of for the bad of people. Whether this has been developed perhaps by the American military as a defense against some kind of nasty attack. But beyond making these general observations, I can't really say there's a definitive answer, and I'm certainly not in any position to be able to do much more than theorize at this stage and hope and pray for the people concerned that they get better.
Well, I think this would be an appropriate time to interject that, as you say, of course, there are antidotes and treatments that are being worked on at the moment, including one by Techmira Pharmaceuticals Corporation, which in fact was placed on hold. The human tests of that treatment was placed on hold by the FDA last month, at the beginning of last month. So actually, after the outbreak even occurred. And before it started to spread in such an alarming fashion, which, again, is an interesting little piece of this puzzle. Also, speaking of the World Health Organization and its potential nefarious effects during these types of pandemics, there is, of course, the very head-scratching phenomenon of of Germany, for example, agreeing to accept Ebola patients at the request of the World Health Organization. And, of course, the U.S. also now is caring for two Americans carrying the Ebola virus, who are apparently being watched over very carefully by a biosafety expert. Although, as far as I know, the quarantine precautions that are being taken at the hospitals where they are being treated are not exactly biosafety lab standard requirement kind of quarantines. It's very head-scratching that this is taking place, and as far as I know, this is the only time this has ever happened, where Ebola patients are literally being flown halfway around the world. I don't know what to make of this, but I cannot see anything good coming of this practice other than the potential for it to spread further. And one would assume, I don't see anything other than that being the point of a maneuver like this, but what's your take on this development?
Well, it could be, as always, things that we're not being told, but we're moving into conspiracy theory. But it is strange that when there have been outbreaks in the past, people have turned their backs on it and left it as a strictly West African problem. Now there seems to be much more interest. Could this be timely and linked to the fact that President Obama is currently welcoming most of the heads of state of Africa in Washington to try and discuss how to develop trade between and investment between the U.S. and the African continent in general? And it would be a pretty bad PR situation if they were manifestly doing nothing about what would appear to be a very serious, at least local or continental concern for Africa. Maybe it's that, I have no idea. otherwise, one could wonder. Perhaps there are other cases of Ebola which have not been declared, which are not actually confined to Africa. And people are beginning to realize that there is an immediate concern that needs to be dealt with. And obviously in the US and in Germany, they've got the best level of facilities in the world to try and do something about it. Or, perhaps they need a few guinea pigs to understand the ailment better. I really don't know. But it is a very different reaction to, they turn your shoulder to the problem that has appeared in the past.
Well, you mentioned, of course, Obama's appearance in Africa, and let's talk a little bit about that, and we'll turn to an Associated Press article that is hot off the press as we record this. Obama announces $33 billion in commitments for Africa. Seeking to strengthen America's financial foothold in Africa, President Barack Obama announced $33 billion in commitments Tuesday aimed at shifting U.S. ties with Africa beyond humanitarian aid and toward more equal economic partnerships. The bulk of the commitments came from private sector companies, including Coca-Cola and General Electric, underscoring Africa's growing appeal to businesses. The continent is home to six of the world's fastest-growing economies and a rapidly expanding middle class with increased spending power. Yet Obama noted that U.S. trade with the entire African continent is about the same as its trade ties with Brazil, and that just about 1% of U.S. exports go to sub-Saharan Africa. Again, a very interesting conference taking place at a very interesting time, obviously, for the continent of Africa, but also with some interesting subtext going on here with some of these billions of dollars of commitments being thrown around run by these giant multinational corporations, which have more of a history of exploiting some of these foreign countries rather than helping them out. What do you make of this conference altogether, the forum that's going on, and these commitments that are being promised?
Well, I find it is a very fascinating development. I mean, the thing that's been curious about Africa for a long time is that basically it has been the fiefdom of the former colonial powers, notably Britain, France, and a little bit the Portuguese. And then, of course, over the last number of years, the Chinese have moved in big time to try and get their hands on natural resources and do deals with the different countries that are involved. And clearly this, literally a land grab by the Chinese is a matter of concern to America. But the African continent, I lived and worked there for 3 years, so I wouldn't say I know it, but I have a certain feel for parts of it. It is vast. It's much bigger than the United States, for example. There are some of the countries there that are almost the size of the United States that are just almost completely unknown to people. But if you take the whole continent, there's about 1 billion people who inhabit it, and the GDP is approximately one and a half trillion. So the average income is about $1,000 a year. And if you compare that to the US with 300 million people and there's a $15 or $16 trillion economy, Africa is running on maximum 2% of the level compared to the US, and it is dripping with resources. I mean, it has got oil in vast quantities, it has got minerals in vast quantities, rare earths. They do export some things. They export cotton, they export cocoa, coffee, and so on. But the country, apart from South Africa, which is included in the S and the BRICS countries, large parts of it are underdeveloped. And there's some amazing statistics going around, like, for example, Nigeria, where, in fact, that's where I lived for my 3 years in Africa. The population from the time I was there until now has gone from 90 million to 180 million. My contribution in that was pretty marginal, I have to say. But you have a doubling in 25 years, and the average age of the population is about 21 years old, because they have been ravaged by AIDS, by other illnesses, by civil wars. Sierra Leone, for example, it's the same thing. There's hardly anyone over the age of 30 in Sierra Leone, because they all got butchered during their civil wars. So there's some terrible legacy problems there, but the continent has an upside potential, which is staggering if they can actually get their act together. Now, the countries are rife with corruption. There's a great deal of lack of education, because if you take the average age of 2021, I mean, you can't have a significant depth of a middle class in an environment like that. But on the upside, there are lots of things to do, and a very small improvement can lead to 10, 20, 30% growth in the economies of these countries if they get it right.
Well, you will allow me then to extract the ominous and potentially dark undertones from this seemingly happy story, and to question the timing and motivation of the United States and these companies in actually making these commitments. And I think we can just jump further down in that same Associated Press article, where it says, the U.S. is hardly alone in seeing economic potential in Africa, with China, Europe, and India moving aggressively to tap into Africa's growing markets. China, in particular, is hungry for oil, coal, and other resources, and is eager to develop the roads, bridges, and ports needed to pull them out of Africa. And this is, of course, a phenomenon that I've been documenting for some time here on the Corbett Report, and many other people have been documenting it besides this this incredible investment in building up African infrastructure that has been underwritten by China in recent years as a ploy, I think, to get access to a lot of those resources, and a quite a successful one in some respects. And, of course, this raises the specter of just last month, of course, what did we see but the announcement at long last of the BRICS Development Bank, which has been rumored and in the cards for a number of years now. Supposedly, they are going ahead with it, $100 billion capitalization on this development bank as a rival to the World Bank that will presumably provide infrastructure development aid and loans and grants to these types of African countries that are developing. Do you see some sort of rivalry in what's happening right now? And do you think that the timing of this is directly related to what we just saw taking place with the formation of the Development Bank?
Look, I mean, these things don't happen overnight, but it must be a matter of deep concern that China is actually digging themselves deeper and deeper and closer into associations with African leaders and African countries. They also don't particularly concern themselves too much with civil rights issues and the internal politics of the country, which puts them in a vastly advantageous position to that of America, where America seems to think it is their right and or duty to try and impose their so-called values on other countries. Now, the other thing that happens, of course, is countries like China do not try and impose their will by military means, whereas in America, if we look at what's going on at the moment, there is a military build-up in Africa. They're trying to militarize a number of countries and provide resources, military resources and advisors, etc., etc. So it's a different approach. But I think if you look at America, what they have to do at a minimum, they haven't even set up any significant bilateral agreements for trade between the, I don't know how many, 50 or 60 countries there are in Africa. There are less than a handful of bilateral trade agreements. So there's a lot of paperwork to put in place before you put the military in place. Now, where it's going to go from here, yes, I mean, I think the establishment of the BRICS rival to the World Bank, I think, is an extremely desirable thing, because competition is always good. And behind the image of the World Bank, there are some, as we know, very, very nasty true intentions. And you look at the infrastructure projects that are actually being put in place. Instead of providing necessarily the infrastructure for the people in the country, it's providing it for the mining companies and the exploration companies, who can get dams built for their hydroelectric power beside where they're actually digging, or provide airports in places that will never be used again, to the detriment of the local people, in order that the exploitation can be achieved by the major multinationals. Now, the big multinationals have been in Africa for a long time. I mean, when my reason for being there in the first place, some long time ago, was to work for a major American multinational. So they've been selling across borders without necessarily digging into the country and setting up, as they've been doing in the Far East, for example, setting up manufacturing plants. There are extremely few. So this would be a good start. And then there also has to be a swathe of mid-sized companies which should be finding Africa attractive to invest in. But again, you come back to the problem of stability, being able to enforce the rule of law, and a workforce which are frequently too young and too under-professionally or technically educated to be of much immediate use. So lots of challenges, but if you don't take on the challenge, then what do? You stay at home and give up.
I guess so. I mean, something has to be done, and things are being done. I guess it remains to be seen if they turn out for the benefit of the average African or not, and you'll forgive my incredulity at the idea that this will actually filter down. But at any rate, it is something to keep our eye on as this continues to move forward, and I think Africa will increase in importance on the geopolitical table. So something to keep in mind for the future. Well, speaking of geopolitical conflict, of course, something that's been going on for the past month or so that we haven't talked about yet here on the Geneva Business Insider is the recent conflict in Gaza. And the latest on that, coming from cbc.ca, a three-day ceasefire begins as truce talks continue. So we have seen at least the momentary cessation of hostility, although we have seen before how quickly that can change on a dime. So we'll have to see if that continues to hold. But at any rate, certainly there has been some incredible destruction and annihilation going on in Gaza over the past few weeks. Nearly 1,900 Palestinians killed, and about 67 Israelis. So let's talk about the conflict that recently happened there in Gaza and your take on it.
Well, I think Gaza has, you know, people look at Gaza without looking at the history. So you really have to go back to the errors that were made basically since the First World War in many ways. you know, with how the country was carved up and how the entire region was carved up. And then the events that led to the actual creation of the State of Israel, and how as soon as the state was created, the Israelis had to fight for their life once again because their neighboring countries invaded. And of course, the British had packed their bags and left after they'd been bombed out of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem by the terrorists of the time, who have now become the prime ministers, foreign ministers, and Nobel Peace Prize winners of the country. So I it would take hours to summarize the situation, but if you have to look at the fact that there is fault on both sides. I mean, I think that when the West Bank was occupied by Israel, they basically have failed for the last 40, 50 years to respect international law. And they have progressively, basically, applied the kind of Warsaw Ghetto techniques on their next-door neighbors. Now, the fact that people retaliate with whatever relatively pitiful means that they have at their disposal, like launching on rockets without any particular guidance, which most of it end up in the countryside, I fully understand. I mean, it's terrible that they do it, but I completely understand why. And then, of course, on the Israeli side, the response to some kind of, Guy Fawkes firework coming one way is to respond with an F-15 with 500-pound bombs. So there is no proportionality between what has happened to what they have suffered and the punishment that they mete out. Now, the other thing that people find it very difficult to understand is how small Gaza actually is. I mean, it's a fraction of the size of, it's smaller than Manhattan. It is the most densely populated country in the world. And Lord knows, I mean, if you go to Hong Kong with all the people living there, you think that's densely populated, but about twice as many people living in Gaza in complete misery, without proper power supply, without proper water supply, without roads. It is a horrible place to be. There's massive unemployment. And then the Israelis come and bomb, and they have now they're now claiming that 44% of the land area that existed before is going to be completely erased to create a security zone for Israel. Well, once again, that practically doubles the population concentration. They seem to have very little, the Israelis have very little regard to the fact that, you know, they can target hospitals, they can target UN schools, they can target infrastructure, they can do whatever they like in their own justification. And, of course, the American Congress seems not only happy to back them, but the American military-industrial complex is happy to provide them with the military equipment to do it. And, it's an excellent testing ground. It's absolutely grotesque. But, new technology is being tried all the time. Israel's a major exporter of military technology. So it's good for business and awful for the poor suffering people of Gaza.
Well, of course, you mentioned the disproportionality of the Israeli response to the events that set off this latest round of incursion into Gaza. And of course, that is very much true, including, as you say, the destruction of UN schools and the destruction of even Gaza's only power plant, etc. Again, vital civilian infrastructure that goes even beyond that disproportional civilian casualty figure that we cited earlier. And as you say, of course, it is done completely with the support, the unanimous support of U.S. Congress. And interestingly enough, I'll just point people to a Blaze.com article that noted the Associated Press had a very, very interesting tweet recently that they eventually they had to revise very quickly. It originally read, "As much of world watches Gaza war in horror, members of Congress fall over each other to support Israel." And they changed that tweet shortly after tweeting it to, "Many U.S. lawmakers strongly back Israel in Gaza war." So interesting how some of these wordings come out during the heat of the moment. But at any rate, again, the disproportionality of the response is one that's often noted. But I think also we should also address the beginnings of this particular round of conflict, where the ostensible reason for this, as we were told, was this this drama where they were the three Israeli kidnapped teens and what was going to happen to them. Will they come back? And then they were discovered to have been killed. We now know that story was mostly fostered by the Israeli government, who actually knew. Even Haaretz is now reporting the Israeli government knew these teens were dead during the time in which this drama was playing itself out. And then even beyond that, of course, this is supposedly a strike against Hamas, but as it turns out, it was not Hamas that was responsible for the kidnappings in the first place. It was a rogue faction. So it raises the question of what Israel was responding to in the first place and how it justifies killing literally over 1,000 civilians in the pursuit of that goal.
One has to wonder whether the bombs that they had in the military stores were reaching their sell-by date and they needed to get another lot in. I mean, for me, the whole thing is absolutely horrific. But there, none of these things happen for the reasons that are stated. You know, we know that only too well. I mean, it's just a minor variant on the false flag principle, which is used everywhere. But you know, beyond that, you know, when people want to have a war, there's no doubt that Israel must find it very difficult to have to sustain random attacks, however ineffective they may be, and it's psychologically for the population, it's very damaging. And you know, people in Hamas, their measure of success is to make sure the other guy is miserable. And it's also true, I'm sure, that you know, rockets have been launched from inside schools, inside mosques, you know, all of the sensitive locations, in order to provoke a response from Israel and to make them look bad. So you have an elected government called Hamas, which was popularly elected, which basically uses their own population as cannon fodder to pursue their own political ends. So we cannot say that on either side there's any particular virtue, but these people need for once and for all to sit down and have a genuine peace talks and sort it out. And I think the best way to try and ensure some progress made in peace talks is to make sure that John Kerry goes absolutely nowhere near it.
Good point. Well, unfortunately, that's easier said than done, given that he is the Secretary of State. Well, again, something that's still developing, and obviously, as we say, the ceasefire that's currently holding, who knows how long that will maintain. So we'll still have to keep our eyes on this as it continues to develop. And speaking of conflicts on the geopolitical stage, of course, since the last time we spoke, another rather major event that occurred was, of course, the downing of MH17 in eastern Ukraine. And not only that, but then the Russian government being hit with a $52 billion judgment against it by the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, which ruled against the Russian government in their pursuit of Yukos shareholders over the course of the past decade. And then in response to that, as we covered on New World Next Week last week, there was a top Putin advisor who was quoted as saying, what does that matter? There is war coming in Europe. And just to perhaps add fuel to that particular fire, the latest coming out just today from Bloomberg Businessweek, Putin lashes out at West as Poland cites invasion threat, saying Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered his government to respond to U.S. and European sanctions, as Poland said a renewed buildup of Russian troops on Ukraine's border raises the specter of a possible invasion. And, of course, that should set off alarm bells in people's minds, because, as we all know, NATO runs on this collective self-defense article, which, of course, means that if any of the members of NATO feel threatened, then they can invoke that right to collective self-defense, and it could suddenly become a NATO intervention very quickly, which, of course, is the big match to that powder keg that we don't want to see happening. Obviously, things remain on a knife edge in this tension, and the latest round of sanctions, just another piece of firewood on that fire. Anything that you would like to talk about with regards to what's happening right now with this this tension in Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I think since the very beginning, it's been very obvious that the West have been provoking, well, in fact, trying to push Russia into a corner. Now, whether this was the EU supporting the idea of expansion of the EU, or whether it's Mrs. Nuland sitting in America thinking as an undersecretary of state that she can push around the second nuclear power in the world by making a few stupid decisions and saying F the EU at the same time, it just gives you an idea of the extent of arrogance of the American elite, or and even more disturbing, I can forgive the arrogance if there was some competence behind it. But it has opened up an enormous can of worms. I think the world never really looks at Russia in a fair, objective way. And if you look at where Russia is geopolitically, they have got the biggest landmass in the world. They've got the biggest borders in the world. They're surrounded by nuclear powers or coalitions with nuclear power. You've got China on one side, you've got India, you've got Pakistan, you've got the NATO powers, and they're sandwiched in the middle. And, this is something America has never lived with. They live hours and hours away from their nearest threat, and their policy at the moment seems to be to go out and try and look for threats in order to hit the other guy on the nose and say, we're defending our national interests by trying to cram you into a corner. So if you look at how Putin has handled the situation, I think he's been remarkably restrained and extremely smart. And when you see things coming out of the Hague, judgments against Russia's state interests, one has to look at the Hague for what it really is, and it's little better than a kangaroo court for Western winners of conflicts or whatever else is going on. And their behavior is pretty politicized and pretty shameless and even stupid. Because at the end of the day, let us suppose that you were one of the beneficiaries of that $50 billion settlement. You don't have to look very far back to Mr. Litvinenko being killed in London to say what your future is likely to be should you decide to collect on this windfall profit that you never thought you were going to have. So the whole thing is a complete joke. I mean, if whatever happens, if there's going to be compensation, the intelligent Russian is going to do a deal with Putin and ignore the court awards in the first place or renounce to them. So there you are. I mean, I must say the person who I think who expresses best my views is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who has done an extraordinary series of extremely well thought through analysis of what is genuinely going on, where Russia is in fact the victim of a very westernized, propagandized war of words against it. And so far, they're the only ones who have behaved in the least warlike manner possible. And I hope it continues that way, because the consequences of them losing their patience could be extremely bad for the Ukraine, the West, and everybody.
Well, of course, that specter of military confrontation is one that tends to really loom large over this this conflict in general. But as many analysts have noted, the wars of the 21st century will not look like the wars of the 20th century, and they will probably more involve cyber attacks and economic warfare than they will boots on the ground and troops firing at each other across trenches. So given that reality, what do you make of these latest rounds of sanctions, the arbitration ruling, the economic ostracization or the attempts thereof of the West to try to basically get Putin and Russia backed into a corner economically? Do you think they're having an effect? Do you think they will have an effect? Or do you think they're likely to backfire on Europe?
Well, I think, taking a helicopter view, American foreign policy is actually going to be the instrument of America's downfall. Because for every measure that they take, which is based on the assumption that their power to decide applies throughout the world, the world is reacting to it and going around it. So we can see that from the decision to the de-dollarization of the world in the petroleum business. We can see that for the formation of rival rating agencies. You can see it in the BRICS equivalent of the World Bank. What is happening very, very, very clearly, although it's going to take a while for it to actually come to fruition, is American power is being diminished by the death of the thousand cuts. And it just seems to me that America is saying, well, you've cut me 10 times, now cut me again, because I'm going to do something that will encourage you to do so. So I really... I fail to see what America is getting out of any of this. And the more you ratchet up sanctions against somebody, the more difficult it is to ratchet them down, the more incensed people get. And the war that is going on between superpowers, nuclear powers at least, can never actually break out into a nuclear conflict because everyone knows the consequences. So what they have to do is they have to use puppet states to fight their battles. They have to have economic wars, which are fought through currencies, which are fought through, for example, the overfly rights over Russia. That is a big thing because I remember traveling often from Europe to the Far East when you couldn't fly over China. That was a big inconvenience, you know, extra legs on flights, longer transit times, longer costs, et cetera, et cetera. So there are all these really tit-for-tat stupidities which are actually benefiting absolutely nobody and just getting everybody peed off with it. And, you know, it's almost like children in a playground. You'd think that they would know better. And at the end of the day, you come down to the vital interests of Europe, and there are some big and powerful states in Europe, some even some nuclear powers in Europe. Are they going to dance always to America's music and say Putin is a bad guy and accept to apply sanctions which hurt America maybe 1% and hurt Europe 30%? So there must be enormous dissensions within this pseudo united group of the EU or the notably the EU or the NATO, because again, if you had Russia on your border, you wouldn't want to provoke them. You know, Ukraine was a very imperfect country before, but it kind of had a composition which satisfied Russia's interests approximately, satisfies the West's interests approximately. It was extremely corrupt and will always be so. And now we have, a civil war going on within the country, which has been created by Western intervention. Because without the Western intervention, it's absolutely clear there would be no civil war there at the moment. There would be business as usual, and the country turning around like Italy did for a long time, 50 years without a government. Now we have people starving in the streets. The things that they say about Gaza are equally true on a lesser scale in what's happening in eastern Ukraine at the moment, with complete lack of infrastructure, people getting killed, hospitals not working, you know, and Ukrainian troops on the one side surrendering because they don't even have supplies to fight, completely demoralized, and on the other side, you know, a pitiful defenseless population being bombarded because the only way that the Ukrainian central government can actually attack is by bombing, because the troops on the ground, they can't support them or motivate them or keep their morale to go and kill their fellow citizens.
Well, I, for one, am certainly interested in how this policy of trying to isolate Russia is going to drive that wedge between the European Commission and the Eastern European periphery, and I think that's going to be something definitely to watch as a result of this, as well as the other factors that you mentioned there. So, again, a moving target and one that we'll have to keep our eye on, but I think that's going to do it for this month's conversation. Once again, I mean, always an interesting conversation, and once again, we've really spanned the globe in this conversation, so I'm always happy to do that and talk with you about this. So we will once again, as always, direct people to your website, GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, where, of course, people can also find out about your financial advisory services by following the link to the FEMISA website at the top right corner of that website. Of course, linked on thecorbettreport.com in the show notes for this interview, as always. David L. Smith, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you again for your time this month.
Thank you very much, as always. And Skype was kind to us today for a change.
Kind enough. Talk to you next month.
I can still just about see you. Thank you.